This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Imagine you're crossing the border between Michigan and Ontario, and a border official tells you to pull over. And then he or she asks for your DNA. That's the scenario that Canadians and Canadian residents will be facing under a new Trump administration rule. It's alarming to some of our Great Lakes cousins, some of whom have work or family over here. Member of Parliament Brian Massey represents Windsor West in Ottawa, and he joins us now to talk about this. Brian, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
When did you learn about the new rule?
Well, it did come up before with regards to a previous administration discussing it back in the early 2000s, but I became aware of it just a few weeks ago as the pilot project kind of slept under the system that we would normally have to recognize these things, and our government never raised it. And as a member of parliament for the area, I was so shocked when it actually came to the public notice.
What's your understanding of how it would affect your constituents?
Well, if you're brought in and detained, even if you don't have a criminal or a charge laid against you, your DNA can be sampling, and that's from the ages of 14 to 79. So it's a broad range of individuals, and it also affects young people. Then on top of that, we're not sure where that information goes other than to the FBI and into a system for data accumulation for, I guess, the future. And so these are the things that give us concern, because not only are you dealing with, you know, you're guilty before proven innocent, it's also people that have been vetted through the process, a green card holder and others that actually have legitimate legal business in the United States that actually has helped build our two great countries together. And this is a stretch with regards to my assessment of keeping us safe and at the same time providing a successful formula for two societies to coexist and be successful to compete against the world.
Now, in America, we know that if you are arrested, DNA samples can be collected and that those may be used to try to compare matches with other investigations. That's a pretty well understood tenet of law enforcement in the States right now. What are Canada's rules about these things? Is this a substantial difference than what law enforcement has practiced?
Yeah, there is. Over here, there's much more protection to privacy. In fact, we have a privacy commissioner, and there's more oversight with regards to how that information is taken, how it is stored, and how it is used. And so there's a lot more civil liberties that are protected with that. So, you know, there is an understanding and appreciation that the United States is a foreign country and we have to abide by the rules, and those are important things. But this sampling, though, that's coming in, you have to remember, it's also catching people that aren't necessarily guilty of anything. And if you're accidentally even brought into the web of this, then you are actually then going to be affected by it. And that information goes in perpetuity to unknown sources. And there's been a whole host of data breaches and information breaches from both our countries over a number of different decades. And we've also had misappropriation of information that can affect people for a long period of time. And even when they had the no-fly list created, they couldn't even get names straight and had kids detained and a number of different problems that still exist to this day because we can't even get names of people right.
I hear your concerns that perhaps this is less about the spirit of the law than the actual practice of how it has worked out with other uses of biodata. But what about the argument that there's nothing to fear from a policy if, in fact, you're not guilty of wrongdoing?
Yeah, I've heard that argument a lot. Usually it's at the expense of civil liberties. And it's one that should give rise and concern because it's always about the enemy we don't know or we can't find or we suspect is lurking about. I challenge these things when the United States and Canada actually threw away a treaty on the Great Lakes that in previous years after the War of 1812, we no longer allowed gunboats out there. We actually, you know, tore up that treaty about a decade ago to allow machine guns and other types of armaments on the Great Lakes under the guise that we don't know what's out there until we go there. But first of all, we're already out there. We already actually have great enforcement, and we also have a lot of different protection through our regular means that doesn't warrant armaments on the water. And so these are oversteps and use of public resources and costs that we have to calculate in terms of what we're really trying to achieve. And if it's more safety and security, there's much better ways. And having data information and DNA sampling and so forth, and especially when you're actually, it's okay to have collateral damage from the begin-go with regards to the policy, is a very weak way to respond to things. And I would say it's not effective for anyone, especially, again, if it's just basically seen as, okay, well, you know, if you get caught into it because we don't want to have the right program and you have to actually give up this information and give up this sampling, it's a poor way to respond to. We have, you know, doctors, nurses, all kinds of people that are going back and forth on the border that are very much part of a great civil society that we have. And likewise, on the Canadian side, with Americans coming over, we've had a great successful relationship, and I'm just not sure that this is going to add an element that we really want to it. And lastly, thickening the border again. This is another way that we actually lose competition when we face against others in the other parts of the world, especially when you look towards the West. We need to, you know, make sure that we actually can compete, and we're adding other layers of complications that could affect our competition.
Do you anticipate this having any effect on tourism?
I definitely do. There's no doubt. When the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, being the Americans' requirements of passports, was brought in, a lot of Americans didn't get passports, and we lost some tourism on the Canadian side. Likewise, on the American side, we have a lot of Canadians that go over there. And, you know, I myself am a Detroit Lions season ticket holder, and others who, you know, may not want to have this level of exposure, especially given the fact that if you're innocent and you're caught into this, it's basically assumed that you just need to accept that. And that's a hard position to take, especially when your private information is so important, and DNA sampling is something that actually is stored in perpetuity for many, many years, and without knowing where that information is going to go and how it's going to be used, and the sampling is coming from you and your body, it's another level of, you know, of invasion. I mean, this is not about a social security number. It's not about a, you know, a number for your passport or something like this. It's actually sampling from your body. So it's a different, you know, set of circumstances than before. And I fear that we're going to grow more distance because, again, what are we trying to achieve here? It's more safety and security. I'm not sure the use of these resources this way and having innocents drawn into it without having any type of accountability for where the information goes, the processing of it, and how it's used in the future is a strong recipe for this entire region that's been built together with cooperation and coordination. And we have everything from family members to business people to our tourism that's all connected for a successful formula that we've been able to achieve in this area. And I just see this as undermining that.
Are you hearing from your constituents already about this?
Definitely. Obviously, with COVID-19, the border has changed significantly at the moment, so we don't really know the full impacts of what's going to take place with this. And we also, too, is, I mean, you know, you made a point that it is, you know, a changing world, and some of this is accepted in other areas, but it's hard to know how people are going to be affected by this. I just don't appreciate the cavalier attitude of it in terms of innocent people being drawn into it, and having 14 and 15-year-olds, you know, basically swabbed going over the border is pretty draconian. It's pretty harsh to have a 14-year-old have to actually go through a procedure like this and not know where that information is ever going to go, and having a stranger do it, and then, you know, having to deal with maybe potential ramifications. And again, I point to the do not call list that has brought in a whole bunch of innocent people into a process that's affected our nations quite significantly, from business relations to tourism to a series of things. So again, I've been very supportive of initiatives that look at providing a safer, stronger, accountable border. But at the same time, when we overreach on these things and we don't really know the reasons, if we just kind of invent, well, we don't know the threats out there until we try to find them, that's not a responsible way for public policy, in my opinion. We're inventing reasons to do things as opposed to actually doing things to prevent things from happening.
This is perhaps a particularly complicated time for Canada with respect to the United States. You know, we're in the midst of this major presidential election, and it's not entirely clear whether the Trump administration is still going to be the partner that Canada is dealing with in a year's time. It's been a hard couple of years for the Canadian Prime Minister trying to maintain a good relationship with President Trump while representing the interests of the country. Do you have any insight for us about why the Trudeau administration would have agreed to something like this?
Well, we really have this policy going back a number of years, and it's been at times just to appease or being scared to stand up against those that say that we're doing this to fight terror and the threats that are around us. And I think that's predominated culture for North America for a period of time, and there's been a number of different initiatives brought in that when you look at them, they may seem on the surface like they're important for those types of elements, but when you actually delve into them, do they really make it safer? And I would argue that some of them are very suspect on that. I mentioned, you know, the Browning machine gun in particular, which was put on the Great Lakes in terms of armaments on gunboats, and they fire over 1,000 bullets a minute. We don't see them much anymore. They also had Black Hawk helicopters for a period of time and so forth. Those things have disappeared at the time being. But they were kind of brought in to say that, well, we're not sure and we need to be safer. But those aren't really good ways of actually doing that. There's counterintelligence with our border teams that has been cut back on. And that's actually been excellent for looking at joint jurisdictional law enforcement to get at illegal drugs, guns, human smuggling, all those different things where you can get to those things and actually stop them from occurring as opposed to being responsive. And I'm not sure sampling like this is going to bring it that way. And this government that we have here, I'm not a member of the governing party. I'm with the New Democrats. We've been a little bit critical of them basically not pushing back enough, because I think there's a lot of progressives in the United States that have concerns about these things. And you got to wonder about building a giant DNA bank in perpetuity with no privacy laws and no privacy commissioner similar to what we have over here, and wonder, you know, is that the best use of public funds? Is it really going to make us safer? We're devoting resources to something else that we could be putting somewhere else, and I'm not sure it's a public policy that is strong, but I got to leave that to my American friends and cousins that we have over there. We want to develop stronger relationships on the border in a better way. I just think that this is a reach, and our government hasn't been helpful in this too, because sometimes, you know, it's hard when you have a friend to stand up and say you're wrong on this, but we just haven't been willing to do it enough, and that's my opinion.
We know what relationships have been like between Justin Trudeau and Donald Trump. It's not a pretty picture. Mm-hmm. What have you observed at the ground level among Canadians and Canadian residents who do come over the border regularly? Do you think that relationship has changed?
It has to some degree, but it still stays strong. So it really doesn't matter what a politician says, whether Trudeau does something that's kind of noticeable with regards to setting off President Trump, or President Trump says something to Trudeau. I mean, I don't really give about that. What I care about is the people that we have interacting on our border that we work with every single day. They're the people that are doing business. There's the family members, like my aunt who's an American, and the type of jobs that we have. You know, my friends and family and others from my community who I represent that go every single day to fight COVID-19 in the Detroit area hospitals, who are value added to your workforce because you don't have the amount of people that's necessary there. And we've kind of come in for a mutual benefit. And just similar to having our American friends come over and visit us on family days over here, tourism, being part of our actual fabric. On our Remembrance Day ceremonies, like your Armistice Day, we actually sing the Star Spangled Banner. And we're fiercely Canadian, but we're very fiercely pride and the American connection that we have. You know, a friend of mine, he just passed away, but he served in the Devil's Brigade. That was a joint Canadian-American force that went behind enemy lines in World War II. And we have all these traditions that go back to a whole series of things that are stronger, and the bonds are stronger than any of the political elements. But we start to thicken the border, and we start to create policies that drive wedges between people being able to get to and from each other. It's when we actually weaken the relationship. And we remember these things. We remember the Detroit Fire Department coming over to help save Windsor. And the same at the time when I was on city council, we had Windsor firefighters volunteer to go in the aftermath of 9/11 to help find survivors and do rescue plans. So these are things that are part of our culture, but they won't be there if we continue to drive wedges between people traveling back and forth.
Brian Massey is a member of parliament representing Windsor West. Brian, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much. And wishing everybody well. And when COVID-19 is hopefully done and we move forward, our bonds are stronger and our visitation starts again, because we all have to stay safe. But at the same time, we still look longingly across the river to friends and family.
First round's on us.
Thank you.
One final note, Stateside reached out to Customs and Border Patrol for a comment on this story. CBP sent us a lengthy statement about its authority. We're going to post that statement at michiganradio.org.